Sheffield Live, made in Sheffield, made by you.
If you like rock in all its forms, you will love Glory Days. You can listen to us locally on 93.2 FM and on the telly, and anywhere in the world on sheffieldlive.org. What do you think, Dawn? You know what? I think he likes it. That's Glory Days, every Monday 1 till 3 here on Sheffield Live. Bosh, bosh. Oops, I've had an accident.
Hello, I'm Harry Wilburn. I present Steel & Wire every Wednesday, 10 a.m. Americana, bluegrass, American roots and more. Lots more. Lots of guests, lots of local music and musicians. That's Steel & Wire, Wednesday, 10 a.m.
You're listening to fabulous Harry Wilburn on Steel & Wire.
It's time to open the music box. Join me, Steve Roden, every Thursday morning between 10 and 12 for music from the 40s to the 90s from my own music collection. Songs I've grown up with, ones I am sure you will enjoy hearing again. Hope to see you then.
If you love new music and you want to discover the best new artists out there, then tune into The Backroom with me, Paddy. I'll be playing the best of new indie, electro, EDM and punk and showcasing new Sheffield talent. Also music news, local and national gig guide and new album releases. So tune into The Backroom every Thursday night between 6 and 7pm here on Sheffield Live, 93.2 FM.
This is Sheffield Live.
N-E-X.
Good morning, welcome to the Life Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live 93.2 FM on digital if you're in South Yorkshire or sheffieldlive.org, talking about science in all its different forms. You've got Julian Paul here live in the studio. We'll be talking to RPG later in the show. This week, and indeed every second Saturday of the month, our guest speaker is Dr. Ogo Osamo, who'll be talking about hydrogen fuel and ITM power based in Sheffield. Exciting stuff. We may even have time to speak to our Phil Muffett from the Mexburn Swinton Astronomical Society. He was on a rather muddy run last week and couldn't speak to us, so we'll maybe fit him in at the end of the show.
Yes.
Next week, and indeed every third Saturday of the month, our guest speaker is Gareth Morgan, who's a member of and also ex-president of the Sheffield Photographic Society. Lots in the news this week, mainly about the weather, but first, remind folks about the Plastic Free Foundation and Plastic Free July. 50% is the predicted percentage growth of plastic being released into the environment by 2040, according to the campaign group, the Plastic Free Foundation, which runs Plastic Free July every year, and it's marking its 15th year this year by calling on people to take its online pledge and commit to reducing their footprint, then share it with others to encourage the growth of a global movement. Every year, billions of single-use items are thrown away, ending up in landfill and on our streets and in our oceans. The pledge is a powerful act that anyone, anywhere can take. It's a step towards a cleaner, safer planet for all of us. So check out plasticfreejuly.org. So all the science news this week is all going to be sort of related to the weather. First off,
right, the Vatican City is now powered entirely by renewable energy thanks to an initiative put in place by the late Pope Francis. The world's smallest state runs primarily on solar energy, powered by a solar hub built on land it owns near Rome. Seven other countries generate 100% of their electricity from renewables: Albania, Bhutan, Democratic Republic of Congo, Ethiopia, Iceland, Nepal and Paraguay. Would you know that?
Very interesting, eh? So the deadly floods in Texas have cast fresh doubt over whether forecasting systems and emergency responses are keeping pace with the growing risk of a changing climate. Warnings were issued before the flood swept through, but the systems do not seem to have been in place to get information to those in harm's way fast enough.
I think they had something like a month's rain in a couple of hours.
Yeah, this is worrying stuff.
Yes, right. Europe, the wildfires that have been raging across southern Europe this month are only the beginning, warned the International Federation of Red Cross and Red Crescent Societies, which has called for more preparedness as fire risks continue through to September.
And meanwhile, the UK's hottest and driest spring on record has overheated rivers, leading to concentrated water pollution, low flows in rivers and more fish deaths.
And back to Wimbledon, according to Wimbledon's head of horticulture, drought-tolerant grass could be used at Wimbledon to cope with warmer weather. The lawn makers responsible for the court said they were looking at more robust varieties of grass and how to keep the plants hydrated.
All very interesting. Closer to home, indeed, a host park ban affecting more than 5 million people came into effect yesterday, which is Friday the 11th of July 2025. It's the first to be declared in the UK this year. Yorkshire Water said the region had experienced its driest and warmest spring on record, with only 15 centimetres of rainfall between February and June, which is less than half of what would be expected in an average year. Yorkshire is the first UK county to face restrictions on water usage amid an extended spell of dry weather nationwide. The ban applies to customers across much of Yorkshire, parts of North Lincolnshire and parts of Derbyshire. It prohibits the use of a hose pipe for activities such as watering the garden, washing the car or filling a paddling pool. Anyone flouting the restriction could be fined up to £1,000. Yorkshire Water said the restrictions are intended to make sure we have enough supply for the essential needs of people across the region this year and next year, as well as making sure we are able to protect our local environment. According to Yorkshire Water, reservoir levels currently stand at just over 50%. A record low for the time of year and significantly below the average for early July, which is nearer 80%. So some other interesting things you can't fail to notice if you live in South Yorkshire, live in Sheffield or Rotherham particularly, that the Royal Horticultural Society has its flower show at Wentworth Woodhouse in Rotherham. And it's starting this Wednesday, the 16th of July, and runs to the 20th of July. You can get tickets from rhs.org.uk/Wentworth. I just wanted to mention one of the gardens from the young designer category. It's a garden by a person, I don't know if it's a male or female, Jacopo Ducato Ruggeri. And their garden is a dune garden, so it's very much about the weather. And it was inspired by the beach resorts of Fire Island in the United States and will have tough plants such as evening primroses and thistles that thrive in sand dunes, plus more unusual plants that spring up near outdoor showers and things like that. It's amazing in your own garden. If you've got like an outdoor water tap, how many things grow exactly where the bits of water splash out?
Yeah, like weeds.
So that's the Royal Horticulture Society Flower Show at Wentworth Woodhouse, the first time. It's normally at Tatton. It will be at Wentworth Woodhouse this year. It's at Sandringham next year, and then I think it goes back to Tatton. And on that note, I'm a member of the Royal Horticulture Society. I do get their magazine, and in it was some great tips about saving water. Important for all of us, not just those in Yorkshire. Leave the lawn alone is the top tip. Resist the temptation to irrigate established lawns during dry spells. The lawn may turn brown, but grass copes well with drought and will green up again once rain returns. The other thing is time it right. Water plants early in the morning to use it most efficiently. This both reduces evaporation and deters slugs. Established plants can survive droughts, so prioritise watering new plants, fruit and veg and any potted plants. Next tip from the RHS, use rainwater. Keep pots and hanging baskets well watered using rainwater if possible. If you're away, group containers together and place in a lightly shaded spot to reduce water loss. Cool conservatories. To help stop plants drying out too quickly, open windows and vents to lower daytime temperatures and ensure good air circulation. Pull blinds or use shading to prevent scorching of plants. Finally, keep houseplants healthy. Ensure the compost is evenly moist when watering houseplants and tip away excess from sources and dishes into other plants. Don't overwater and allow the compost surface to dry between waterings. All good tips. So this week's news, science news this week, has always been about the weather.
Stormy weather at 57 Mount Pleasant Street. Well, it's the same room, but everything's different. You can fight the sleep, but not the dream. Things ain't cooking in my kitchen. Strange affliction wash over.
Track there from Crowded House, of course, 1991. Can you believe Weather With You? Because this week's science news was all about the weather. Stay cool and safe wherever you are. You're, of course, listening to Live Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live 93.2 FM on digital if you're in South Yorkshire, or SheffieldLive.org. We should have our PG on the line. Good morning, PG. Oh, where is he? We think something might have been pressed on the desk, or is it me? Are you there, Paul?
Hello there.
Oh, he is there. Yeah, it's me. It's me. I didn't plug you in, Paul.
Oh,
oh, I know. This modern, these modern techniques we have to use to get you.
Technology, who'd have it?
Who'd have it, exactly. Hope you're staying cool in this hot weather, Paul.
Yes, trying to.
Yeah, it's not good, is it, for humans, animals, birds?
No, no.
Not good at all.
It's sort of one of those areas that sort of caught my eye this week, and that's that a cooling device might help to prevent hair loss in chemotherapy.
Ah.
So, I've been doing some research, but a technique to prevent cancer patients losing their hair has been developed, and it combines a scalp cooling system where the patient wears a cap because it's the top of your head that tends to be a problem with the heat that's generated. So I'm saying that this will help to reduce hair loss and damage caused by the cancer drugs, with a lotion also comprising the same antioxidants found in red grapes.
Oh, interesting.
So, Yeah, the study's been hailed as a milestone. It's also pinpointed the optimal temperature for the scalp cooling as the most effective one for keeping the hair. So cold caps are used by some cancer patients during chemotherapy to help minimise the amount of hair loss. But the technique has been developed in conjunction with researchers from Sheffield Hallam University.
Oh, good local science there. Yeah.
So they found out that 18 degrees centigrade is the temperature that can help to prevent losing, whereas cooling down to 26 degrees centigrade may not provide enough protection. The team has also shown how combining that with topical antioxidants, which is the thing that's derived from the red grapes, and Dr. Nick Georgopoulos of Sheffield Hallam University said the reason why people get hair loss is because at the base of the hair follicles, where the rapidly dividing cells are actually feeling the toxicity of the chemotherapy drugs. So they are great at killing the cancer, but they also have this sad side effect, which a lot of people say is one of the things that they really sort of get upset by in their treatment for cancer. So losing your hair is one of those things, I think, that is fairly universal, I think, for people. Some people don't mind, as a lot of men follow the trend these days and take their hair off, but it seems a great bit of local sort of science getting involved and making life better for patients.
Yeah, because I think I've always known about the cold caps, but obviously they're taking it a step further then.
That's right. So they're combining it with the antioxidants, and I say it's looking very positive. So I thought that was a good
great.
Bit of
yeah.
local news. And then sort of sitting sweltering in the sun, I started to think, oh, it'd be nice to go out to the seaside. And I thought, I wonder how many people are drawn to the sea when we've got this kind of temperature. And sort of just looking at it generally, again, I've sort of covered it before, but oceans cover just over 70% of the Earth's surface with salt water. You've got Pacific, the Atlantic, Indian Ocean, the Antarctic in the southern hemisphere, and the Arctic in the northern hemisphere. And they contain 97% of the water on Earth. So again, sort of looking on the local front about the hose pipe ban and everything else, across the world, there's actually less than 3% of water. I think it's just over 1%. Between 1% and 2%, that's what they call potable, drinkable water. it's a limited resource and needs to be looked after. And I think we can all have a discussion about whether the companies who are supposed to be looking after our water are doing a great job. But obviously there's a big impact on us, and it's blamed on climate. The oceans are the main part of what's called the hydrosphere, and it's a reservoir for heat, and it's a big part of the Earth's energy budget. And there's a carbon cycle, a water cycle, and it's also the driver of our climate and our weather. So ocean life is responsible for over half of Earth's atmospheric oxygen. And most of the human activity that impacts on that's coastal, but fishing as well, things like that. So the ocean's a big sort of important part of what we do. And within that, another bit of sort of news that caught my eye is something at the opposite end of the scale, a tiny creature. This is a report from BBC News, which says tiny creatures gorge, get fat, and help to fight global warming. So that's the story of a tiny, obscure animal that's quite often sold as aquarium food, and it's been quietly protecting the planet from global warming by undertaking what they could call an epic migration, according to this research. So the particular organisms are called zooplankton, or often they're called zooplankton, but I think it's zooplankton. And they gorge themselves and grow fat in the spring before they sink hundreds of metres into the deep ocean in Antarctica, and there they burn the fat. This locks away as much planet-warming carbon as the annual emissions from roughly 55 million petrol cars. So it helps to stop from further warming the atmosphere, and it's so much more than scientists who did this research had expected. But as they uncover that sort of massive service that they're providing to us all, the threats to zooplankton are growing. So they spent years probing its annual migration into Antarctic waters or the Southern Ocean, and what it means to the sort of changes in climate that are happening around us. So the findings, they say, are remarkable, and the lead author is Dr. Guang Yang from the Chinese Academy of Sciences, adding it forces a rethink about how much carbon the Southern Ocean stores. So again, we've covered the loss of ice covering, the changes to Arctic and Antarctic that are happening, and the big push in the north. There's a big push by a lot of countries for access to resources that are starting to become uncovered. But on this particular study, the animals are the unsung hero, because what they say is they have such a cool way of life. So compared to the most popular Antarctic animals like the whale or penguin, it's a small but mighty contribution that's often overlooked and underappreciated. So I say quite often you'll see mention of them as fish food, which obviously the oceans, they do offer that as well. But their life cycle's a bit odd and fascinating, they say. It's a copepod, a type of zooplankton that's a distant relative of crabs and lobsters. It's from 1 millimetre to 10 millimetres in size. So it's very tiny, and it lives asleep somewhere between 500 metres and 2 kilometres deep in the ocean. And you can see they're sort of taking some pictures under a microscope, where you can see there are long sausages of fat inside their bodies and fat bubbles in their heads. Sounds like somebody like me. But Professor Daniel Mayer's photographed them in Antarctica, and without them, the planet's atmosphere would be significantly warmer. So globally, the oceans absorb 90% of the excess heat that humans have created by burning fossil fuels. And of that figure, the Southern Ocean is responsible for about 40%, and a lot of that's down to zooplankton.
Isn't that interesting?
It's amazing. Millions of pounds have been spent globally to understand exactly how they store carbon. Obviously, the big thing where we talked about carbon capture as being one of the saving graces, but that's a tiny animal is making such a significant contribution. And they're saying that they were already aware that they contributed some carbon storage in a daily process when the animal's carbon-rich waste sinks down to the deep ocean. So they eat stuff and then they produce a carbon-rich waste that goes down into the bottom of the ocean and obviously stores carbon. So when they migrated to the Southern Ocean, what this contribution did has not really been quantified until this latest research focused on copepods, as well as other types of zooplankton called krill and salps. Well, krill is often mentioned in regard to whales as being one of the big food sources for them, and one of the reasons why they migrate over thousands of miles to the places where krill and these food things are found. So they eat phytoplankton on the ocean surface, which grow by transforming carbon dioxide into living matter through photosynthesis. That turns into fat in the zooplankton, and they say that their fat's just like a battery pack. When they spend their winter deep in the ocean, they just sit and slowly burn off this fat or carbon. So again, maybe a bit of guidance for us all.
Well, it's a fascinating thing because obviously David Attenborough's just done his film The Ocean, which I've not seen. But yep. It's what he's trying to explain, because you can't see the bottom of the ocean bed, yes, generally, can you? You've got no idea what's going off down there. But actually, it seems like the ocean, as you said, is fundamental to a lot of things that we're probably only just waking up to.
Absolutely. I think, you know, it's been a source of food, fishing, and I think nowadays much more often pleasure. But I think humankind, through history, have clung to the shorelines when they've been developing. You can sort of see that in the migration of humans across the planet, that quite often they'll be following the sea line or the coastline when they move from one place to another. So it's, I mean, this research team's calculated that this process of collecting the carbon from the surface and taking it down below transports 65 million tons of carbon annually to at least 500 metres below the ocean surface. So it's a great contribution from a tiny animal. And I thought this, earlier this year, Dr. Freer and Professor Mayer spent 2 months on Sir David Attenborough's polar research ship near South Orkney Island and South Georgia. Using large nets, they caught zooplankton and brought the animals on board. And then they worked on them in complete darkness under red light so they weren't disturbed.
Wow.
And others worked in a room that kept at 3 to 4 degrees centigrade, and they have to wear a lot of protection to stay there while you're looking down their microscope. So a lot of good thermal underwear, I guess.
I was going to say, we could do with a room that's 3 or 4 degrees.
Yeah, well, we'll probably take the cooling cap technology and see if you can get some cooling chairs or something.
Yeah, it's amazing when it's hot weather like this, you open the fridge or freezer and you're like, oh, this is nice.
It's very nice to see the change, but I think David Attenborough's documentary is being released, and I think when it's available, everybody should have a look at it,
because
it's
definitely
another real awakening, I think, for let's say, it's incredible to think that 97% of our water is locked up in the oceans, and so the whole world is surviving on less than 3% of drinkable water.
Which is interesting, because when I saw some of the things that Yorkshire Water said, what they're looking at in the next 10, 20 years, like desalination plants. We're an island surrounded by salt water. It's like, somebody might have thought of that before.
Well, a lot of countries in Arabia use desalination plants as their primary source. As we talked about the Sahara Desert, and below the Sahara Desert there are aquifers with fresh water. But again, mentioned before that so much water has been taken out of the ground, it's actually affecting the rotation of the planet.
It's mind-boggling stuff. Fantastic stuff, Paul. Sit back. We've got a cracking track selected by your good self, Queen. Ooh. Seven Seas of Rye.
Thank you, Paul.
Yeah, it's a cracker.
It is. Bye-bye, Paul. Speak to you Monday. Glory Days Rock Show, 1 till 3. Bye.
Bye, guys. Bye.
You're very souls, you unbelievers.
Great track there by Queen, Seven Seas of Rye, of course. And we played that because we were talking to our PG about the importance of the oceans and the seas. So fascinating stuff. Of course, you listen to the Life Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live 93.2 FM on digital if you're in South Yorkshire, or sheffieldlive.org. We should have Dr. Ogo Osamo on the line. Good morning, August, sir.
Good morning, Julie. How are you doing?
Very well. I'm trying to keep cool. You're loving this weather, August, aren't you? Admit it.
It's lovely.
It's lovely. No, you're probably wearing a jumper. Brilliant stuff. Thank you for joining us, August.
Thank you, Julie.
This week, you're going to talk about hydrogen and a company called ITM Power, which is Sheffield-based.
That's correct.
So when did you first know about ITM Power? Because I think they were founded about 25 years ago or something.
So many years ago, that's correct. And they used to be based, they're now based at Shepcott Lane, but they used to be based at Brightside Lane when they were started.
Did they? Right, yeah.
Yes, and ITM Power designs and they manufacture, you know, integrated electrolyzers based on PEMs, you know, proton exchange membrane technology. These are all, you know, mouthful words and terminologies.
Yeah.
But what they're essentially doing is producing what's called electrolyzers. And electrolyzers are used to produce green hydrogen. So the method they use, is based primarily on using renewable electricity and tap water. So the renewable electricity comes from the wind turbine, for example, which was how they started. No, when they started off, they were using solar energy.
Were they? Interesting.
Yes, then they migrated to using the wind turbine, to generate the electrical power they needed for the electrolyzer production. And the electrolyzer, you know, what its function is to conduct electrolysis.
So did they build the... I know there's a wind turbine at the Advanced Manufacturing Research Centre, isn't it, off Sheffield Parkway? I think that's in Rotherham. But did ITM Power build a wind turbine specially for them, or did they use the wind turbines that were over in Waverley anyway?
They used the wind turbine that was at Waverley to begin with.
Ah, right.
You know, the scenes, anyway, developed technologies that enables them to effectively conduct electrolysis, i.e. breakdown of water to generate hydrogen and oxygen.
Yeah, which is, it sounds so simple. But I guess it is simple, but were they the first to think about this could be a way of producing clean fuel?
No, they were not the first, but they were amongst the first to take this technology forward, you know, develop this technology further. Electrolyzers were known about, you know, for quite a while, and, you know, it's like ideas that initially start and people investigate it further and gradually. America, for example, in America, that's, you know, there are people who've been looking at electrolyzers for a while. But yes, they took it on and they worked hard at it, and they're amongst, you know, the world leading electrolyzer manufacturers at the moment.
And they're based in Sheffield, which is fantastic.
Shepcott Lane now, they have a massive set up at Shepcott Lane where they produce electrolyzers, yes.
So can you explain how they're using wind power. So the thing about it being green hydrogen, I'm aware there's different sorts of hydrogen, because the green hydrogen means it's been made from a renewable source. So that's either sun or wind or something like that. Because you can make hydrogen from other ways, can't you? Using electricity or gas or something else. Yes. So do you want to explain how they do it then? Paul's laughing now. He's saying, come on, I'll go.
Yeah, in terms of renewable energy, what happens is that if you take wind turbine, for example, the wind turbine receives, it's got this big, vanes that turn around. Basically, wind turbine is, a device that wind impacts on. It turns around, i.e. the rotor, that then goes through a turbine. A turbine basically is a set of magnets around which, within which copper coil is, or some conducting material is, that turns around. It causes electricity to flow. Okay, the turbine causes electricity to flow through that mechanical wind impact on the big vanes that turn around. I'm trying to keep it as so that electricity that's produced, because the wind is constantly, when it constantly occurs, it doesn't. That's the renewable side of it, because it's a constant supply. Now, once that electricity is generated, it is harnessed, used in electrolysis. And electrolysis is a process whereby water is broken down into hydrogen and oxygen, which is the objective, really.
Yeah.
To produce hydrogen. Now, that hydrogen is then stored, and you can use it in, electrical energy production for cars, for example. So you have, you need to have a car with a fuel cell, and that fuel cell is what produces electricity that propels the car.
Yeah. We used to have a hydrogen, when we worked in the air quality team in Sheffield, which we all did, we used to have a hydrogen van, interestingly, and its only emission was water.
That's correct, because the fuel cell, when it functions, produces electricity, and it reconverts hydrogen back to water.
So you used to see a little trickle. We used to say it had a wee. I think that was a technical term.
Yes, that was my term.
But you know that technology to have a hydrogen van? I mean, as far as I can tell, I know Toyota way back were looking at hydrogen. But at that point, the vehicles were quite expensive. The technology, the batteries, the whole system was quite expensive. Do you think in the future it will take off much more?
Oh, there are loads of. If you drive around in Sheffield, you'll find lots of electric vehicles driving about. It's gradually becoming cheaper, because initially there's usually a massive cost when you introduce new technology. But as more and more people use that technology, and there's more and more production, costs gradually comes down. So, but with government intervention, for example, it makes it easier to bring forward the reduced costs. So government is given a lot of grants, to enable. If you remember, there was a point when you want to buy an electric vehicle, the government actually pays, I've forgotten what the percentage is.
And to be fair, these things, they don't happen overnight. And to be fair, a lot of modern cars now, we see, or you don't really hear them driving around as much, they're so quiet. They are actually electric, or the petrol hybrid, or they're a combination, if not pure electric.
Yeah, there are lots of pure electric. Okay, just mention the ionic Tesla. You know, the electric vehicles, and operate on, you know, fuel cell technology.
Yeah. So hydrogen, though, is it quite flammable?
Hydrogen, yes, it's flammable, but you're not burning it.
No.
That's the idea of the fuel cell. The fuel cell allows, you know, it allows you to convert hydrogen, the chemical energy in hydrogen allows you to use that in producing electricity. But this is different to, for example, a battery contains a fixed supply of energy. Fuel cells do not require charging, for example, but you need a battery. You need to charge a battery, stores that energy, and then releases it.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, fuel cells, they, you know, take energy from the electrochemical reaction that takes place, you know, within that fuel and within a cell. So when you pass hydrogen, for example, in a fuel cell, what happens is at the anode end, that hydrogen releases its electron. That electron that's released, if you connect wire to it, produces electricity. But on the other side of it, you have to supply. So that's the anode end. At the cathode end, you have to supply air, where oxygen mops up. You know, there's a reaction that takes place and oxygen becomes reduced. In other words, accepts the electron. So what you're getting there for is a flow of electron taking place. And that, when you connect electrical wires, you get electrical, you know, energy flow.
Wow.
I know you're
a chemist by background, Ogo, but it is complicated stuff. But there is a... So if you've got a hydrogen van, as we had, I never drove it, but it used to go and get refueled at ITM, I think it was ITM Power's refueling station off the parkway. So, that means what's happening there, hydrogen that's being split. That's
being produced.
Yeah, and where's that put into then? Is that put into the fuel cell?
No. When it's split, it's stored in cylinders and all that. And then just as you go to a petrol station to, you know, take petrol or pay for, you know, put petrol in your car, you go to the fuel cell station, I mean the, what's called the ITM power station at...
It's Waverley, isn't it? I think
it's Waverley.
Off the park. In Rotherham, yeah. We will have to say it's in Rotherham.
It's in Rotherham.
I know.
Yeah, and you know, you take your hydrogen from there, the same way you fill up. Petrol tank. You fill up your hydrogen tank, and then your vehicle is already designed to be able to use that hydrogen.
Yeah.
To convert, you know, to produce electricity, to be able to drive the car.
And it's a pure, it's one of the it's one of the cleanest forms, isn't it, of renewable energy?
Yes, and as you've already said, in that process, all that you emit is water.
Yeah. I remember when we worked together, Ogo. Said hydrogen was the future.
Indeed. because the technology is fairly straightforward, understandable, you know, technology. Electrolysis, people have always known about electrolysis, basically the breakdown of water.
Yeah, splitting.
Into hydrogen and oxygen, or the splitting of water into hydrogen and oxygen. And then the reverse process is what takes place in the fuel cell, where hydrogen and oxygen are combined, and in that process, electricity is produced.
Mind-boggling.
And that means it's used to drive the car as today we see on the road.
And Sheffield-based, fantastic. Oh, good. You've done a great job there of explaining it, because not everybody knows about hydrogen. So brilliant, Ogo. Thank you. Thank you very much for joining us and sharing that, because it always sticks in my mind. You said hydrogen is the future. People might not realize it yet.
Yeah, and a lot of people who invested at that time are smiling. Yeah,
I bet they are. I know. Great stuff, Ogo. Enjoy the rest of your weekend.
Great. Enjoy
in the sunshine. Bye bye, Ogo. Thank you. Bye.
Child, I'm such a man for a short while. Promises be the world just spins faster than me.
Come on.
And all of your friends, I hear I was free. You left me for the government. And all of your friends are hopelessly. I wish you'd stop wasting all my energy.
Come on.
All of your friends are now whispering. I think you left me for the government.
Energy by Collective Soul there, because we're talking to Dr. Ogo Osamo about ITM Power, Sheffield-based company, and hydrogen fuel. All exciting stuff. Listening, of course, to the Life Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live 93.2 FM. We should have our Phil on the line. Good morning, Phil.
Good morning.
What an exciting morning you have had. Oh, is it as exciting as last Saturday?
Yes, it is. We're at Bluebell. We're doing a Bluebell Wood charity event today.
Oh, yeah.
The three dragon boats, as we speak, are just racing across the lake. And if you can hear that noise in the background, it's the drums and the people shouting.
Wow. So you're at Manvers Waterfront Boat Club on this very warm Saturday.
Very warm indeed.
Go on, tell us the exciting news. You've had a selfie, haven't you, this morning?
Yeah, I've just had a selfie with John Healy, Defence Minister. He's our local MP and he's dropped in this morning with all his security guards and had a walk round. I've managed a selfie with him.
And why is he at Manvers?
So, well, he's our local MP, and he comes every year to support the charity.
Hey, that's really good.
And all, yeah, he's took a very busy day out of his schedule to come and visit us, which is really, really nice.
Wow.
So, and we get some money for hiring the dragon boats out. We're also running the event. And then, obviously, all the teams, there's 24 teams, I think, today, they all generate their own money for charity. So we're helping out with that as well.
Fantastic.
Our stuff free.
So very quickly, we've got about 10 minutes. We couldn't talk to you last week because you were doing some strange and long, muddy run or something.
Yeah, tough mudder.
You're mad.
Down to Grantham, it was a 15K run.
You're mad.
With an assault course running through it. My daughter kind of signed me up to do it with my wife. So we did a team members event, and I think it took us 3 hours 20
you are
minutes
just
to
mad.
Get round.
Madness!
But there was all abilities. We went round individuals, and there were some really, really fit people turn up. And when I saw some of the people, I thought we're not going to get round this.
So but you did. You did it.
There was only one obstacle I didn't attempt, and that was a 4-metre, 5-metre high scaffold. You had to jump off into a big muddy puddle, and it was deep, and it was just too much.
I stepped in
far. I tried, Yeah, I went through the electric cables. I went in the ice bath. I went under the barbed wire.
You're mad.
Through the mud. I did all that, and it were absolutely terrific. So, that last week.
Well done. You are crazy.
I expected finishing for the radio show last week. I was still on the course.
It's fine. You survived. So tell us, Eye on the Sky Club news. What's the most important things going off then?
Well, at the moment, it's the 3i Atlas object that's been discovered. And at the moment, we've got an interstellar visitor that's going to fly between us and Mars. Now, being July, the best constellations in the Southern Hemisphere to see are Sagittarius and Scorpius. And last week, when we had the clear spell, or was it the week before? I'm not too sure. I was trying to photograph some of the objects in Sagittarius, like the Lagoon Nebula, which is difficult. I can't see it with my eyes, but take a long exposure photograph. These gas clouds and objects come out. Just so happens, and I didn't know this, I was so close to being in the same field of view as photographing this interstellar visitor. I was probably about 2 degrees off. If I'd have known, I could have perhaps photographed it. But anyway, over the next year, it's going to move from Sagittarius into Ephesus and then across into Leo, where Mars is at the moment. And towards the end of the year, it's going to fly between the Sun and Mars and fly back off out into deep space.
So what is it exactly?
This object is a deep interstellar. I can't say it's an asteroid or a comet because we don't know. It's a large rocky body that's at least as big as an asteroid, and it is drifting through space at a terrific speed. I think it's something like 60,000 kilometres an hour.
Good grief.
Which is like at a fast cometary speed.
So is this something new that's not been seen before?
Yeah. So in the past 6 years, we've discovered 3 intergalactic objects. There was the Borisov, which was, I think it was in, was it in 2018? And then a couple of years ago, we had Moa, which is a Hawaiian name, which was a long cigar-shaped rock that flew through the solar system. Now this is the third one. So I don't know if you know, recently we've had some deep sky survey telescopes being built around the world. There's one in Hawaii, one in Chile, one in South Africa. And these are like big aperture telescopes taking big images. And what they're doing is they're doing sky surveys. Because the optics and the size of the chips are so big, they can actually photograph big pieces of sky and then run it through computer software. The computers can identify which objects are moving through the sky. And then any that we don't already know about that are in the computer base, people then look at them and say, right, what's this object we've never seen before? Well, it just turns out we're getting really, really better at finding
them,
objects that we've never seen before.
And do we know where they're coming from?
Well, outside of our solar system. So this one is in Sagittarius, coming towards us. So it's coming out of the centre of the galaxy. Now, I'm not saying our sun might have pulled it towards it, or it's been ejected from another solar system, but it's a rocky body that must have been part of a system that no longer exists, that's coming through our
interesting. Will it ever reach us then? As in,
well, it's going to go between our orbit and the Martian orbit, so it'll roughly pass through the asteroid belt. However, we're going to be at the other side of the sun when it passes past Mars, so it will be nowhere near it. But what I'm going to try and do, I was hoping to get the camera out the past couple of nights, but it's been a full moon.
And
because of where the sun is and the ecliptic, the full moon's in like Sagittarius, so the sky's not dark enough. But if we keep this good, if we've got this weather next week, I'm going to be trying to photograph this object because it just might be within camera reach of amateur astronomers.
So this is a new challenge then?
Yes. Yes.
It's exciting. You're excited, I can tell, because
I'm excited that I might be able to photograph this.
Yeah, yeah, something brand new.
When we couldn't photograph the other two because of the timing. Because, as you know, as we're going around the sun, things passes in the daytime as well as the nighttime. We can only pick up the nighttime stuff. So if where this is situated at the moment in Sagittarius, and it's going to move into Ephesus, it's due south above the horizon, and so long as the moon's not there, it'll be photographable. It's just the magnitude that's going to be the next issue. But with saying that, it might be a case of we'll use the observatory to get a longer exposure parts with the
telescope. Oh, this is your observatory at Hoover Stand, yeah, which must have been boiling the last few days.
Well, yesterday was up there building a concrete step into the observatory and just stood there doing nothing.
Yeah.
I got sweat in my eyeballs. It was torture. Anyway, we did a bit of concreting yesterday. We were mixing it as well. We've been doing a new disabled access.
Said you'd done well for that. You got some funding for it, didn't you? Amazing.
Yeah, we've got £1,000. I think we've spent about 800, I think.
Wow, that's brilliant. So, you know, this new object then? It's not just you in your club, Mexwin Swinton Astronomical Society, wanting to photograph, is it? Is it a bit of a competition now? Who gets the best picture?
Loads of people will want to photograph So it was discovered in the summer by Southern Hemisphere telescopes. It just happens it's going to be on the ecliptic, which is like it's like a visible part of the sky we can see, especially at this time of the year. So it might be too faint for me to photograph, but it's not going to stop me trying.
Not going to stop you trying.
You don't know what you're going to turn up until you try.
So this must be quite exciting, because you say actually summer is not the most exciting time to view the sky for lots of reasons, because it's lighter until the evening and everything. But this is a bit of piques everybody's interest.
Yeah, that's right. So 2 weeks ago, when that cleared a couple of days, I was out in shorts and T-shirt. I got bit to death by mosquitoes. But I managed to get a couple of deep sky objects in Sagittarius I've never seen before, because the camera is so much better than the eye. I've been tweaking my telescope to keep light out of it where it's not wanted, and I've been able to get darker images. My next point is getting rid of the street light, or I don't know, I might put a hood over the
I know I you said a this. Long pole, just I need go a, and I need talk to Rotherham Council and just say, look.
They're hard to get hold of. I work there.
I know you do.
You can't speak to street lighting.
I know. We used to work for Sheffield Council, so we know all about it.
You just can't phone them up and speak to them. And I work for the place, so all you people out there that struggle with local authorities, even people in the local authorities struggle with people in their other local authorities.
Who work there struggle, who'd work for a council, I know, but we did. Yeah. Never mind. Yeah.
So there are some lovely objects to see. Overhead, there's like Cygnus and Lyra and the Milky Way.
Wow.
So if you're in a reasonably dark
sky, you can see them.
Yorkshire,
yeah.
You can see them coming overhead.
Go and put that hood on that. Really... Go and put that hood on that street. Yeah. We're gonna have to let you go, Phil, because we've got 10 seconds. Have fun at Manvers. You too. Thank you, Phil. Enjoy today.
Nice
you too. Bye bye.